Now, I want to start today by wrapping up heart function. I just realized the projector is on, so I'm going to turn it off. You can't see it, but I want to talk a little bit more about heart function and about circulation. And then we're going to go on and talk about homeostasis and the function of multicellular organisms as a whole. So if we go back to 19C, we covered the top of that handout. And what this whole handout is about is trying to show that the electrical properties of muscle cells correlate with the properties of the channels that they have, and that each type of muscle cell has different channels and different electrical properties. And you should realize that all of the action potentials, etc., shown on this handout are for muscle and not for nerve. We haven't emphasized it, but muscle cells are excitable also. Now, the pictures at the bottom that I've drawn, redrawn here on the board reflect what's going on in a pacemaker cell. And we actually had this picture before, the very first panel. We had this on a previous handout. Now, where threshold is here, this is more minus, less minus, more plus. Now, a pacemaker or an autorhythmic cell fires action potentials without any external stimulation. And the question is, how is that possible? And we discussed this last time, that these cells don't have a constant, stable, resting membrane potential. As soon as the action potential is over, what happens is that the cell membrane gradually depolarizes. It does that spontaneously without any input. If there is input from neurotransmitters or hormones, that will alter the slope of this line, alter the speed of the depolarization, and that will affect how long it takes to get to threshold. But the cell basically will do it all by itself. And this gradual depolarization, this is referred to, it's labeled over here on your handout, this is the so-called pacemaker potential. Instead of a resting membrane potential, you have a pacemaker potential. Now, so the pacemaker, the cell gradually depolarizes till it hits threshold, then you get a standard action potential, and then the process starts over again. Now, the next two panels illustrate how this correlates with channels and ion movement. So if you look at the next panel, it follows the ions. Now, this picture describes what happens as a result of certain channels. There may be additional channels involved as well, but we'll stick to the ones for now that are on the handout. And the idea is, in order to depolarize, what has to happen? The cell inside has to get more positive relative to the outside. So one way this happens is that sodium goes into the cell, as shown on your handout, and that eventually triggers the entry of calcium. Now, if this were an ordinary action potential, what ion would rush in at this point? It would be sodium. But in pacemaker cells and in all smooth muscle, what rushes in is calcium, meaning that the voltage-gated channels here are calcium. So the channels here have to be calcium, voltage-gated calcium channels, which generate an inrush of positive and a spike. But now, what causes the cell to go back to its previous state? Positive has to go out to get back to where you were. And this is the same as the usual. Potassium goes out. And therefore, there must be voltage-gated potassium channels here. Now, you might notice here that it says here IF channels. These are what are called funny channels. That's what the F stands for. And the reason they got this name is that they open at low voltage, at negative, polarized state of the cell. The usual voltage-gated channels open when? When you get up to threshold, when you get more toward the positive, these open when you get more toward the negative. And that's why they were named funny channels. Now, the exact channels involved here are not critical, but what we're interested in is the idea that the cell gradually depolarizes because it gets more positive on the outside, inside relative to the outside until it hits threshold and you get a spike for calcium and potassium out. Now, there are pacemaker cells in smooth muscle, in some smooth muscles, and there are pacemaker cells in the heart. Most smooth muscle cells do not have a pacemaker potential, and most heart cells don't either, because most heart cells are contractile, not pacemaker. But where are the pacemaker cells in the heart? And to make that a little clearer, we have the other side of the handout, which illustrates the setup of the heart and the basic circulation. Now, this is a so-called subway diagram, because especially with the old-fashioned subway maps, the lines were very distorted. What was clear was the connectivity. What is connected to what is made clear by this diagram. But where things are in space is not at all. And that's why the two pictures in the middle are there, especially the one on the left, which is just a picture of a real quote-unquote heart, to show you the anatomy. Because, for example, this spot on your picture is actually on the top of the heart. This is where things come out of the heart, and the heart is actually folded, so these are on the top. And that's not at all clear from this picture, but it's much clearer from the picture on the left in the middle. Now, what does this subway diagram illustrate? It illustrates that the heart actually has two halves. We have a double circulation. We have two atria, these are two, and two ventricles. And you notice they're not connected at all. So the blood flow comes in through one atrium, pushed into the ventricle, pushed into the body. And then the blood comes back around to the other atrium, pushed into the ventricle, pushed through the body. So we have a double circulation. And that's diagrammed actually on the bottom, where we have that little picture that looks like this. Except these are the two halves of the heart. This is actually the right half, and this is the left half. Now you may notice that I label them backwards. That's because when people show you a picture of the heart, it's always the way it would look if someone were standing facing you. And therefore, the right side of the heart is always on your left, and the left side of the heart of the patient or the person facing you is always on your right. So this is the right part of the heart. Now, blood from the body comes into the right heart part. Now, since it came from the body, it's low in oxygen, and it has to be pumped to the lungs. So the right half circulates blood to the lungs. So blood is pushed into the atrium. From there, it is pushed into the ventricle, the right ventricle. From there, it's pushed out to, it's going to go to the lungs. So this is the pulmonary circulation. This blood vessel is going to go around to the lungs, which is clear in this picture. So the blood is going to go from the right atrium to the right ventricle to the pulmonary artery to the lungs. And then it's going to go in the pulmonary vein back to the other half of the heart. And then it's going to go from the left atrium to the left ventricle and then around to the body. Now, in the lungs, of course, we have exchange of gases. Each of these boxes in this picture represents a set of capillaries. What is special about capillaries, which are very fine blood vessels, is they are not surrounded by smooth muscle. Other blood vessels are surrounded by smooth muscle, but these are not. Therefore, there's a very thin barrier between the inside and the outside of the cell, and gases can diffuse across readily. So in the lungs, which gas are you going to pick up, and which gas are you going to lose? You have to worry about oxygen, and you have to worry about CO2. So in the lungs, you're going to pick up the oxygen and dump the CO2. But then when the blood gets around to the body, you're going to do the exact opposite. The tissues have been generating CO2 for metabolism, so the blood is going to pick up CO2 and the oxygen is going to diffuse out into the cells. Now these arrows refer to what happens in the blood. What happens in the tissues is exactly the opposite. Now one of the reasons for bringing this picture is to make it clear that the blood flows in parallel through the various organs. Your blood does not go from your heart, say, to your muscles, and from there to your liver, and from there to your feet or something. Instead, the blood has parallel circuits, each going through a different organ. Each of these parts of the systemic circulation gets oxygenated blood. So in the lungs, it gets filled up with oxygen, and then it flows, say, through the muscles or through the kidney, etc. Then, so the blood goes this way. Now, one other piece, so if we look at this picture, the blood would go out here into the pulmonary circulation, around through the lungs, back into the left half, through the left half, out through the body, and back in to the right. Now, how do you name arteries and veins? We tend to think of it as carrying oxygenated blood versus carrying deoxygenated. And that is true for the systemic circulation. That these are all arteries, and up here are all veins. And in between are the capillaries. But it's the opposite in the pulmonary circulation. And the reason is that the way you define arteries and veins is by, relative to the heart, whether they're afferent or efferent, whether they come in or whether they go out. What goes out of the heart is an artery. So this is an artery, the pulmonary artery, even though it is low in oxygen. And this is the pulmonary vein because it's going back to the heart. So all of that is marked on your handout. But everything we've talked about so far really involves the contractile cells of the heart. Where are the pacemaker cells? So the two major nodes of pacemaker cells are right here, marked on your handout. Now, there's a whole system of pacemaker cells which make up a conduction system throughout the heart. And the first part of it is right here. This is the sinoatrial or the SA node, and this is the atrioventricular or the AV node. And when you have nerves from the autonomic nervous system, either the parasympathetic or the sympathetic, which are releasing neurotransmitter, they're doing it by contact with the SA node. They are dripping neurotransmitters on the SA node cells and causing them to have a flatter or more steep pacemaker potential. Now, what happens is that the SA node has a rhythm, which is either speeded up or slowed down by the input from the autonomic nervous system plus hormones. And then that sets off the AV node, and that sets off the rest. And it's easier to see in the middle right picture exactly where the various parts of the conduction system are. So let's just look at that very briefly. That we have here the SA node, the AV node, the bundle of His, and the Purkinje fibers. So these are the Purkinje fibers, this is the bundle of His, and these are the two nodes. And there's a connection here and a connection over to here. And this is shown in your handout, although it may not be as clear as it should be. Now, each of these tissues is muscle, not nerve, but each of them is autorhythmic, or a pacemaker, and fires its own action potential spontaneously. But each part is slower than the one before. So normally, the SA node fires an action potential, which triggers off the AV node, which hasn't got to threshold yet, which triggers off the bundle of His, which triggers off the Purkinje fibers. Now, this seems like a sort of strange setup. The reason for this setup is, or the rationale as to why this has been selected, is that the SA node sets off the atria. It causes them to contract. And notice that there's a pathway across, so both atria contract. But there's a barrier here, and there's a barrier here, so that that signal would not set off the ventricles. But there is connections in this system between the SA node and the AV node, and the AV node and the bundle of His. Now, the bundle of His doesn't go through the ventricles. It goes through the divider between them. And it's the bundles of the Purkinje fibers here down at the bottom that actually set off the ventricles. And notice where they are. They're at the bottom. So the result of this system is to cause the ventricles to start contracting from the bottom up. And if you look at your real picture of a heart, you see that the arteries come out the top. And so it makes sense for the ventricles to squeeze from the bottom a little bit after the atria and push the blood up the top. Okay. Now, I think this is really all I wanted to say about the heart. And now I want to switch and talk about homeostasis. But let me ask first what questions there are about any of this. Yeah?
Since this is at the tail end of lecture 19, is this going to be on the exam?
This does not on the exam. The idea of this, we've already discussed, and that's on the exam. Everything we talked about last lecture, is on the exam. Any other questions? Yeah.
You emphasize calcium.
Well, where does the sodium fit in this pacemaker business? As far as we can tell here, the sodium is involved in the pacemaker potential, but it's not involved in the depolarization of the spike, unlike with skeletal muscle and with nerve, and with cardiac contractile cells. Other questions? Yeah.
So all of the cells in the sinoatrial, atrial, ventricular, bundle of His and Purkinje are pacemaker cells, and just get set off.
All of these pink cells are pacemaker cells, except that the slope of the pacemaker potential is flatter in the Purkinje cells than it is in the bundle of His, than it is in the AV node, than it is in the SA node. So normally, the SA node controls the whole operation. And if the SA node fires, then the AV will fire slightly after that, and the bundle of His slightly after that, and the Purkinje slightly after that.
What's the nature of the connection? Is it like gap junctions? Like how does that
Well, I think these are all connected by gap junctions because these are modified heart muscle. Yeah?
Where in the scheme do the capillaries fit in?
Where do capillaries fit in? This is an artery. Arteries branch into smaller vessels called arterioles. And they branch into capillaries. And then the capillaries come together to form a venule, and the venules come together to form veins. So what we're saying is that arteries, arterioles, venules, and veins are surrounded by smooth muscle, but capillaries are not. So this is where most of the exchange occurs of materials between the blood and the tissues. Yeah. No, the atria contract first. I don't know what I said before, but the atria contract first, and then the ventricles contract afterwards. So the atria fill with blood, And then that blood is pushed into the ventricles, and then the ventricles contract, pushing it either into the pulmonary circulation or the systemic circulation. Yes? I believe that all smooth muscle has an action, a spike, due to the inrush of calcium and not sodium. Okay. So we've been talking about various pieces of specialized tissue or cells or even an organ like the heart. But I want to talk now about how all the various parts of the body are coordinated to get something done. And so first I want to talk very briefly about the difference between the lifestyle, so to speak, of a unicellular organism and a multicellular organism such as yourself. Now this is explained in words in your notes, but we're going to talk basically about the little table which is there, which summarizes the whole idea. Unicellular and multicellular organisms have a distinctly different lifestyle. And one way of looking at it is what surrounds the cell. In the case of a unicellular organism, what surrounds the cell is the external environment. Now, one of the questions is, can the organism regulate what is around it? And a unicellular organism cannot. It just has to put up with whatever is there. And so primarily its job is to respond appropriately, say with induction or repression of the appropriate enzymes, in order to be able to metabolize whatever there is today. But a multicellular organism is different, in that within the organism, each cell is surrounded by body fluid. So the internal environment, what is sometimes called the internal milieu, is what surrounds each individual cell. And the organism as a whole can control the makeup of those internal fluids. So the makeup of your blood, of your lymph, of things like that can be maintained at a fairly constant state. And one of the functions of each cell in your body is to contribute to that maintenance. So if you ask, how many functions per cell? In the case of a unicellular organism, it has one job, and that is to grow and reproduce, to maintain itself and survive. But every cell in a multicellular organism has two jobs. One is its job to maintain itself. Often it doesn't divide, but it maintains itself, replaces its parts, and keeps itself going. But in addition, it contributes in some way to the maintenance of the organism. Either it pumps blood, it protects you with your skin, it does something else. So it has two jobs, which means that this cell is specialized while a unicellular organism is not. Now, I want to say a word about the terminology of this external internal milieu, or the fluid surrounding the cells in the body. That you have what is called the extracellular fluid, which is everything that is outside the cells. But that's actually subdivided into two parts. Of all the liquid that's not inside a cell, some of it is in the blood, the plasma. It's in the blood vessels surrounding the blood cells. And some of it is outside of the circulatory system and is just in between the cells. And that's the intracellular fluid. We've talked about that before, the IF. So there's the extracellular fluid and the intracellular. No, intracellular is the wrong word. It's written right in your notes. This is the interstitial. Interstitching. That's the trouble with using abbreviations. Okay, so this is the extra, can't be intracellular because it's between the cells. So the extracellular fluid is composed of the interstitial fluid in the spaces between the cells, not blood cells, and the plasma, the liquid part of the blood. And we'll be using these terms off and on. Now, the point in a multicellular organism, the composition of the plasma, the ECF, and the IF are all kept more or less constant. And the original person to describe this, Claude Bernard, said you have a constant internal milieu. And the process of maintaining this constant state is called homeostasis. So what we're going to be talking about for the next couple of times is, especially today, but we'll wrap it up next time, is how you maintain homeostasis. What are the homeostatic mechanisms that keep things more or less constant? Now, in order to do that in a multicellular organism, obviously all of the parts have to be coordinated. For example, the blood, the heart has to beat faster or slower in response to need. Now, in order for things to be coordinated, you have to have these specialized cells, and the specialized cells don't operate by themselves. They're organized into tissues and organs and systems. Now, we've already talked about tissues a long time ago. We said that there are four main tissue types, or five, depending on how you count, in the organism. And I want to talk about something that's made up of all of them. Because what we want to see is how you put together the various tissue types to get something done. Now, you may remember there's epithelial tissue. There's connective. And then there's muscle and nerve. We've talked a good bit about how muscle and nerve work. We talked a little bit about connective, about the idea of making extracellular matrix, which is what distinguishes connective. And we've talked a bit about epithelial layers, how they're used for absorption. Now, this is the four major kinds. Some people consider blood connective tissue, and some people consider it a fifth category. Now, in an organ such as the heart, you have multiple tissues all working together. And rather than the heart, I want to look at a classic example that has all of them. And that's on your handout on 20B. Now, what this represents, actually, is the lining of your gut. You may not think about that, but your GI tract, or your gut, is actually an organ. It's a very important organ for absorbing food and breaking it down into a usable form and sending it off to the parts of the body where it's useful. And in order for that to happen, you have to have a complicated organ with multiple layers. Now, this right here on the top is the epithelial layer surrounding the gut. And we've talked about this before. When we talked about glucose absorption, we drew these cells. We pointed out that they have microvilli. So we drew the cells sort of like that. And we talked about the various connections between them, gap junctions, adhesive junctions, etc. And we said that if you eat glucose, that glucose is in the lumen then of your gut, because this would be the lumen. And then you would have this layer around it. That the glucose transported with sodium into these cells and then flows down its gradient through a different transporter into the body. But in order to complete this process, you can't just have a layer of epithelial cells. They have to be connected to the rest of the body. They have to be supported. You have to have blood vessels to carry away the glucose and to bring in other nutrients. You have to have nerves in order to control both the passage of material down and across. So this represents all of those layers. So to get some idea of how this actually works, I have brought a model. So if we consider what that picture represents there, this would be your gut. Okay, this little section. This would be the lumen. These are the cells around it. Now we know these are indented. That's what this represents. These are actually, this is not flat, but it's indented. But what we've done here is to cut a little bit actually across this way. If you were to cut it and you were to ask what is this layer and what's the next layer and what's the next layer and what's the next layer. So this is the middle layer and these would be the cells, the epithelial cells. Now the next layer is connective tissue, which would be around the outside. And that provides mostly support. And then you have two layers of muscle. Now, this is a cross-section of the various layers. So this is all smooth muscle, but this represents muscle that goes around this way. And this is longitudinal muscle, which goes that way. So if I put them in, so the circular muscle, sort of like this, goes around. And that allows you to adjust the volume of the gut. And then you have longitudinal muscle, which is arranged this way, which allows you to shorten or contract and helps to push this stuff along. Then you have a layer of nerves, which allows you to send messages in and out. So let's put on a layer of nerve. And then you have another layer of circular muscle. So we'll put on some more circular muscle. And then you have another layer of nerve. So put that on. And then you have another layer of longitudinal muscle. And finally, you have another layer of connective tissue, which connects the whole thing to the body wall. Now, this is to give you some idea of the complexity in what we think of as a fairly simple thing. It doesn't have just one kind of tissue. It has all four. And I didn't put any blood vessels in. There's one on your picture. There's that little T-tube-shaped thing. That would be a small blood vessel. And in addition to everything else, there are some glands in here, which we've left out for the moment. So this is their form from epithelial tissue, as we'll explain next time. So that even perhaps the simplest organ contains many different layers, and all of these different kinds of tissues have to cooperate in order to get anything done. So now let's see how they do it in some specific examples. Now the organs, of course, are organized into systems. We are not going to either name them or go over all of them. How many systems there are depends on who's counting, and you can look at your books if you like. And we will talk about a few of them, but by no means all. Now, how do the various organs cooperate to maintain a constant internal milieu, to maintain homeostasis? We want to talk about some specific examples today, but first I want to talk about the general principle involved. And the general principle of maintaining homeostasis is called negative feedback. Now, what is meant by negative feedback in physiology is that the system is self-creating. Self-correcting, excuse me. meaning that there is some desired value, say for temperature, for blood glucose, for ion concentrations, for pH. If the system deviates from that, whether it gets too high or too low, the system takes action to correct. So what gets negative, what gets negified or negated, what is negated is the difference between the desired value and the actual value. Which means sometimes you have to lower the value, sometimes you have to raise the value. Sometimes you have to inhibit a process, sometimes you have to activate a process. But as long as you return the system back to its desired value, it's called negative feedback. Now notice this is different than the usual usage of the term in English, where negative feedback means somebody said something that wasn't positive. Negative feedback in biochemistry also sometimes means something else. Negative feedback in biochemistry usually means, or molecular biology, usually means that the end product inhibited at an earlier stage. This isn't always inhibition. Now, as explained in the notes, that some of the terminology in physiology is different from equivalent terminology in other fields, and that it's usually clear in context, but some of the examples are explained in your notes. So negative feedback means that you're self-correcting. Now, just to make that clear, how is that different from positive feedback? What is positive feedback? Positive feedback means that when you get a little bit of a variation or a difference from the set value, that variation makes for a bigger variation, makes for a bigger variation, and so on. Now, you've already met one example of this. The action potential is a classic example of positive feedback. A little bit of positive charge causes more positive charge, which causes more. Positive feedback usually means that you have a process which is self-igniting, that a little deviation causes more deviation until boom, and then you start over again. As Dr. Feierstein says, the famous toilet. The toilet, the action potential, birth, and sex are the classic examples. Why sex? A little arousal makes for more arousal, makes for more arousal until boom. And then you may or may not start over. So all of those are examples of positive feedback, and we'll actually talk about a specific example later. Lactation is another example. But we're going to concentrate first on negative feedback. Now, if you have negative feedback, does that mean that your variable is exactly the same all the time? It means that if your variable gets a little too high, you put it back. If it gets a little too low, you take action. So in fact, your variable is going to go like this. It's going to vary a little bit around some set value. It's not going to be exactly constant. So let's look at an example of how you use negative feedback to maintain the constant level of something. And the first example that I want to use is the regulation of blood glucose. And so that's on 20A, on the top. Now, what are the features of a negative feedback system? First of all, you have some regulated variable. You have something that you want to keep within, keep almost constant. So in this case, the regulated variable is the glucose level in the blood. This is the regulated variable. Now, this diagram is a classic seesaw picture, which illustrates that you expect to have a certain value. This is the value you're aiming to keep the blood glucose at, and this is called the set point. But the glucose level can get over that, it can get under that. So that's the point of putting in the little seesaw. the glucose level can get too high or the glucose level can get too low. Now, we're going to look first at what happens if it gets too high. As in this case, in many, many situations, you have two real paths to the circuit or the seesaw, one for correcting if things get too high and one for correcting if things get too low. So it's sort of like having both a heater and an air conditioner. When it gets too hot, you don't just turn off the heater, you also turn on the air conditioner and vice versa. So let's look at the top half. What happens when the glucose gets too high? Well, first of all, you have to know. So you have to have what's called a sensor. You have to have some organ somewhere that detects the level of glucose. In the case of glucose in the blood, that sensor is in the pancreas. Now, once the level in the glucose in the pancreas is detected, it is compared in some way to the set point. And we're considering a case where the glucose level is higher than the set point. What now? So what happens then is a signal is sent from the sensor to whatever organ is going to do something about it. And that's called the effector. There's actually more than one in this case. These are what actually have an effect. In this case, if the glucose is too high, what should you do about it? You want to take glucose out of the blood into the cells. So the effectors do that. They in some way suck up glucose from the blood. Now, for the moment, we're just going to leave this as a black box. We're going to say what's in it, but we're not going to talk about the molecular details of how this works. We'll come back and do that later. But the effectors for doing this, actually, are the liver, adipose tissue, that means fat cells, and skeletal muscle. These three are capable of taking up glucose if it is high. Now, what is the signal to do it? I just drew an arrow here. In this case, the signal is a hormone. It's the hormone insulin. If the blood level is too high, the pancreas releases insulin. The insulin is an endocrine hormone that travels through the blood and binds to receptors on the liver, adipose tissue, or skeletal muscle and triggers the uptake of glucose. So the glucose level then falls. The glucose level in the blood falls until it returns to the normal value. And once it returns to the set point, the desired value, no more high glucose is detected, no more insulin is sent out, and there's no more action by the effectors. So that's sort of circuit one. But as we said, you usually have two compensating circuits. So what's the other half? Let's suppose you have to have, it turns out it's the same sensor in the pancreas. Just write sensor. If it detects that the glucose level is too low, then it has to signal effectors to do something about it. The effector for doing something about it turns out to be the liver. All three of these tissues can take glucose up, but only one of them can release glucose, and that's the liver. Sometimes the effector is totally different, sometimes it's the same, sometimes it's overlapping but not the same. Now, again, the sensor has to send a signal to the liver to do something about it. Now, clearly you can't send insulin because that's the wrong signal. And you use a different hormone. If the glucose is too low in the blood, then the pancreas releases the hormone glucagon. Glucagon goes to the liver, causes the liver to release glucose into the blood. The glucose level rises. And we're back, we hope, to where we're supposed to be. So because of this, what's going to happen to the glucose level in your blood if you measure it over time? It's going to look like this. It's not going to be absolutely flat. It's going to be sort of wiggly. Okay. Now, before we go to the next example, what questions are there about this one? Yeah.
So it has to, it's like the pancreas keeps releasing insulin until it notices a change in the glucose concentration in the blood at the pancreas again.
His question is, what does the pancreas do? As long as the pancreas detects glucose is too high in the blood, it releases insulin. Once the glucose falls back to this level or below, insulin is no longer secreted. And conversely for glucagon. Yeah?
Is the set point a set value or a range?
Is the set point a set value or a range? It turns out it depends. Some people just talk about the set point, meaning anything above triggers a correction, anything below triggers a correction. More commonly, there's actually a range around the set point. So if this is the set point, nothing happens until you get, say, up to here or down to here. So if you get below this value, correction set in. If you get above this value, correction set in. Now, to distinguish these points at which correction set in, as opposed to the value you're aiming at, people sometimes call these also set points. But when they're being more careful, these are called critical values. So the critical values bracket the set point, and they're the points at which correction set in. Yes?
So then type 2 diabetes is an example of insulin depletion, or?
Now, what about diabetes? Failure to produce insulin is type 1 diabetes. Failure to respond to insulin is type 2 diabetes.
So there's your body can theoretically make an infinite amount of insulin?
Can your body make an infinite amount of insulin? Well, in theory, I suppose it can. Do you run out of insulin? No. Insulin is a protein. You have genes for that protein. And in response to the glucose level detected by the pancreas, the appropriate cells in the pancreas either synthesize or release insulin, and ditto for glucagon. Now, both of these are protein hormones. So normally, they're made by the cell and stored in vesicles. And normally, the cell has a supply on hand. And in response to the glucose levels, exocytosis releases the appropriate hormone. But the hormone is then continually made to keep up the supply. Yeah?
Based on like the hormone circulation, is there usually an overshoot up and down, like as it's varying around those points?
Overshoot of what?
Like, will it keep producing insulin, and since that's circulating, it takes a while, is it going to go then to be too low and then
her question is the level of insulin going to be too low or too high? This relates to a point I was going to make later, but it's very important. Are you interested in maintaining a certain level of insulin in your blood? The truth is, you don't give a damn. The level of insulin is going to vary. The level of production of insulin is going to vary. The level of uptake of glucose or release of glucose is going to vary, but you don't care about those. Those can be adjusted and turned up and down so as to achieve a steady level of glucose. Glucose is the regulated variable here, not the level of insulin or the level of glucagon. Those are not regulated in the same way. Nobody cares. They go up as needed. Now, the question is, do you make insulin past the point? Probably you do, because notice this. Her question is, do you have a little insulin around which causes your glucose level to get a little too low and then you have to take correction? Probably. One more, and then we're going to go on. Yeah?
Is the sensor, is this sensor the same in the top half and the bottom?
Is the sensor the same? As far as I know, it is.
So is it just a matter of whether or not glucose is binding the ligand to trigger the release of insulin versus not binding and it triggers the release?
Well, we are deliberately avoiding the actual molecular mechanism by which this works. It relates to certain enzymes inside, the supply of certain metabolites in the cell, because glucose is converted to something else. And it depends on the supply of that metabolite what happens. But somewhere, you have something like a bimetallic strip. You have two things binding, and if they're this way, you do one thing, and if they're that way, you do the other. Okay. Now let's go on to our second example. It has many of the same features, but it has a few additional ones. And this is the seesaw picture, well, sort of, on the bottom of the handout, which is the control of body temperature. Now, in many ways, this process is similar. It's negative feedback. You have effectors. You have a regulated variable, except this time it's body temperature. You have a set point for that variable. If you get too hot, you take corrective action. If you take too cold, you get corrective action. So you have two circuits as before and two sets of effectors. Now, what's different here is, first of all, you notice that there is something called an HT in this picture. HT stands for the hypothalamus, which is a gland which is actually part of the brain. And it coordinates many, many different aspects of homeostasis. The general term for what it does in this case is it acts as an integrative center. Or IC. In some circuits, you don't need a separate integrative center because the integrative center compares the real value to the desired value. In the case of a circuit like this, the sensor does that job. But in the case of temperature, the two are separate. The sensor is separate from the integrative center, which takes the information from the center, from the sensor, and decides what to do about it. Now, one of the reasons that you need an integrative sensor that's separate in this case is there are multiple sensors for temperature. You have two sets of temperature sensors. You have one which measures your internal body temperature and one that measures your skin temperature. So if we draw the circuit again, we have the regulated variable and a set point. And suppose our variable gets a little too high, meaning it's a little too hot. So this is picked up by the thermo, that is the heat sensors. I've written here thermoreceptors, which is the same as sensors. There are special cells with special proteins, which in fact change shape in response to temperature. Which reminds me, the people who tried the what do you shut off if you do this on your upper lip? If you use a really sharp pencil, you set off cold sensors. Now, you probably have cold sensors here on the outside, so if you compare to here, you may not notice it. But you don't have cold sensors here. So when you feel cold, it's not the pencil lead's cold. It's that you hit and deformed a cold sensor. But to come back to this one, this is a heat sensor. And the heat sensors, there are two of them. There is one that in the brain that detects your core temperature, probably part of the hypothalamus itself, and one in the skin that detects your surface temperature. Now, why do you need both of them? You want to keep your core temperature approximately constant. But if it gets too high, what you do about it in part depends on what's on the outside. If you're hot inside and hot outside, you better do something fast. But if you're hot inside and it's cool outside and your skin is cool, if you just wait, it'll take care of it. So the action you take depends on both the information from both sensors. And so that has to go to the integrative center, which in this case is the hypothalamus. Now, in addition to having an integrative center here, there's another difference. how do you send a signal from a sensor somewhere else? How do we do it before? We use the hormone, right? Is that the only way to get a word, the word from one part to another? There's also nerves. So in this second circuit, it's actually a nervous connection between the sensors and the integrative center that carries the message. So this is actually a nervous connection, not a hormonal connection. So the hypothalamus then, again through nerves, sends a message to the effectors. And they, what you want to do is you're going to increase heat loss. And there are actually three effectors here. They are smooth muscle, sweat glands, and the brain. Now, how would they increase heat loss? It turns out you can't decrease the heat that you generate. As a result of your metabolism, you generate a certain amount of heat as a byproduct, and you can't cut back on that. But you can change whether you hold it in or whether you radiate it. So what does the smooth muscle have to do? The smooth muscle around your peripheral vessels can contract or it can relax. If it contracts, that tends to hold the heat in. If it relaxes, your blood vessels dilate, and there's a larger surface area, and more heat is lost through radiation. So these dilate your peripheral blood vessels and increase heat loss. Now, we understand about sweat glands. If you sweat, the evaporation of the water consumes heat and cools you off. So that's another way to cool you off, by increasing sweat. Now, what does the brain have to do with it? The brain affects your behavior. And if you are hot, you can take off your sweater. Now, you can only go so far in the taking off clothes department. But you can, in fact, change your behavior. You can sort of spread out to increase the surface area. You can take off your heavy clothes. By behavior, you can cool off to a point. So this changes behavior. And ideally, you radiate enough heat so that the level falls and you go back to where you were, where you're supposed to be. But suppose you get too cold. Suppose your body temperature falls below what it's supposed to do. What can you do about that? Well, as usual, you have two circuits. You have the same set of thermoreceptors. Not entirely the same, because I think in your skin, the cold and the hot receptors are not the same. But you have thermoreceptors, again, both for the core and for the skin. And they send their information through nerves to the hypothalamus. And then the hypothalamus signals the effectors to warm you up. Now, what are the effectors this time? Can you use the same organs to warm you up? What about your smooth muscle? Sure. Instead of relaxing, it will contract around the same blood vessels and hold in the heat. So the smooth muscle, operating in the opposite direction, will warm you up. What about your brain? Well, your brain affects your behavior. You either get yourself you hold the heat in, you put on a heavy coat, you turn up the thermostat, all those things. So the brain also affects behavior leading to warming. Now, what about your sweat glands? Can you use them to warm you up? Well, you can prevent them from cooling you, but that's about it. You can't use them to warm you up. Is there anything else you can use to warm you up?
Skin.
How do you use your skin?
It contracts.
Well, it's true that you can contract your skin a little bit and raise your hairs like with goosebumps, and that makes a small difference. But there's another major difference. That's a good one, but I want to put another major one in there. Well, you can't increase metabolism usually in the short run. In the long run, by controlling thyroid hormone, you increase metabolism. If you live in Alaska long enough, you eventually walk around without a coat. But in the short run, there is something you can do, which you've probably all done.
Shiver.
And that's using your skeletal muscles. They're contracting and running the bridge cycle only for the purpose of generating heat and not for the purpose of moving anything or generating any force. So you're using them as a heat generator. Now notice that when you warm up, you conserve heat. When you cool down, you radiate heat. But in addition, when you warm up, you can actually generate more heat. You can't generate less, but you can generate more. So by shivering, you can actually generate heat. So your capacity to get yourself warm when it's too cold exceeds your capacity to cool yourself off when it's too hot. And that's why people do better in cold, excess cold, than they do in excess hot. Now let's see if I forgot anything. Well, maybe we should all sort of put it together and look at the final diagram, which is on the other side, which is looking at the circuit from a slightly different point of view. So what we've drawn here is to blow up, really, one of the two halves of the seesaw. Each of these homeostatic systems has two circuits, but we're going to now just do one and see if there are any features in summary that we want to put in. So we've got here a typical circuit. We have the regulated variable, which we've explained. And then we have a sensor which detects its level. And that sends information to the integrative center. And that sends information to the effector to do something. And that changes the level of the regulated variable. Now, one thing we should add to this is that information comes both in and out of the integrative center, which is usually part of the brain and the central nervous system. So again, we use the terms of afferent information and efferent to the effector. Now, what about the signals that go on these arrows? From our two examples, we see the signal can be either hormonal or neural. Now, the issue came up before of, are we trying to keep a constant level of a particular hormone? For most hormones, the answer is no. We're not interested in maintaining a constant level of the hormone. We're interested in maintaining a constant level of the regulated variable through the use of that hormone. And we have more or less hormone as needed. Now, we also mentioned last time, earlier, that there are processes going on in this effector. It can be taking up glucose, releasing glucose, raising the temperature, cooling you off, heating you up. Those processes are adjusted. They go faster or slower to make the desired correction. But we're not trying to keep them at a constant level. We don't want glucose release to always be the same level. We want the glucose final level in the blood to be the same. Whether that takes release or whether that takes uptake, we don't care. So the effector has processes going on that are adjusted. But how do you keep that straight from the variable here whose level is adjusted? So people talk about the regulated variable, but they talk about controlled processes. Such as glucose release, glucose uptake. And there are usually two sets of controlled processes, one for upping the regulated variable and one for lowering it. the old air conditioner and the heater. Now, this is negative feedback. But does that mean whatever controlled process you're talking about, you always slow it down? And the answer is no. For example, if the glucose level, say, in the blood is too high, so the glucose in the blood is too high, well, we could inhibit release of glucose. But we could also activate uptake of glucose. So this, the negative feedback doesn't have to be to inhibit something. It could be activating something that fixes this. And we've already mentioned that there can be multiple sensors and there can be multiple effectors. And if you have two loops, the effectors can be the same or they can be different. And as we've already mentioned, but let's just say it one more time, the net result is that the regulated variable won't be exactly constant, but will be kept within fairly narrow limits. So I want to talk about two aspects of this circuit that we haven't touched on yet. And this has to do with the properties of the integrative center. We assume that there is a set point and critical values which determine when you make corrections and when you don't. The integrative center is capable of making adjustments in the set point and the critical values, thereby changing what happens. And a good example of that has to do with fevers. Everybody knows that when you get a fever, you suddenly feel cold, you pile on the blankets, and you get comfortable. Everybody else thinks you're too hot, but you're comfortable. Then when the fever breaks, suddenly you're boiling hot, you throw off the covers, and you cool down. How does that work? The idea is that if this is temperature, you have some normal set point. Let's just put it here. And it has critical values. And so normally you're at this temperature, and if you get higher than this, you're uncomfortable and you cool off. And if you get lower than this, you're uncomfortable and you warm up. So you shiver down here, and you sweat up here. Now, when you have a fever, your integrative center resets the set point. So this is the normal, but when you have a fever, the set point is, say, up here, much higher. So here are the critical values. So if you get above here, you sweat. And if you get below here, you shiver. Now, when the integrative center kicks in and raises your set point, what is your temperature? On this scale, where is your temperature? You're normal, and suddenly your brain says, new temperature desirable. But what's your temperature now? You're here. So your temperature is here, and the set point's just been raised on you. So what are you going to do? You're going to shiver, because you're below the critical point. So you're going to shiver and pile on the blankets until you get up to here. So this is what happens when you start a fever. Now what happens when you get better and the fever so breaks, as they say? Your brain says, okay, back to normal set point. What temperature are you? You're here, right? So let's write it here. So compared to normal, you're here. So what do? You sweat, because you're above the sweat point. And you sweat, throw off the blankets, etc., until you get back down to normal. So this is what happens when you return to normal. Now, the point of why do you do this? We think that when you have a fever, it inhibits, the high temperature inhibits the growth of many bacteria. It interferes with their iron metabolism. So if the fever doesn't get too high, it doesn't cook you, but it does in the bacteria. Now, needless to say, if the fever gets too high, it's dangerous because it can denature your proteins and mess up your function. But a little fever might be good for you, relatively speaking. Now, we also mentioned another phenomenon, though we didn't give it a name. So in addition to adjusting the set point, having an integrative center allows you to do what's called feed forward or anticipation, otherwise known as planning ahead. Remember we said that you have two sensors for temperature, your internal core temperature and your skin temperature, and what you do depends on both sensors, not one. And this is an example of planning ahead. If you're hot inside but your body's skin temperature is cold, you don't really need to do anything as long as you aren't too hot. You can just wait and you will cool down due to the cold air. Now you can look at that as, that's an example of feed forward or anticipation. You can look at it that your integrative center instructs you to ignore the normal set points, or it's readjusting them. That is the critical points. You can look at it either way, but either way you take a different action than if you didn't plan ahead. Another example involves insulin. We were talking before about overshoots and undershoots. When do you need insulin? When there's too much glucose in your blood. So you're going to need it. If you eat a meal, there's going to be too much glucose in your blood and you're going to need insulin. But you generally secrete the insulin first. In response to the eating and the food, you start secreting insulin before the glucose gets too high. And this is another example of anticipation. So the insulin is there when the glucose hits. You don't have to wait until the glucose gets too high. Now, we said we would talk temporarily, quickly, about an example of positive feedback, just in contrast. These are all examples of negative feedback, where you keep something at a set value, hopefully indefinitely. And this is also, you have homeostasis for things like the pH of the blood, the ion content, not only the plasma, the interstitial fluid, but keeping it constant. But consider lactation. This is the production of milk, breast milk. You have to get the supply and demand adjusted. But this is an example of positive feedback because the more the baby suckles, the more milk you make. And when the baby starts to suckle, you let down the milk because you have to both make the milk and you have to release it. The amount of milk production and the amount of release increases in proportion to stimulus from the baby. This is a case where you use both hormonal and neural signals. We'll do the circuit later when we get to the hormones. But the mechanical stimulation from the baby causes a nerve signal to go to your brain, and that sends hormones back to the breast to increase milk production and milk release. So that's an example of positive feedback. The more suckle, the more milk. And of course, when the baby stops suckling and reduces the input, then you stop making milk and the supply decreases to meet reduced demand. Yes?
What about mothers who express milk while they're still pregnant before the baby has been born?
Mothers who express milk before the baby is born. I thought you couldn't do that because of your hormonal state, but maybe you can. Well, maybe you can, and a lot of these things depend on multiple stimuli. But for any expressing milk mechanically has the same effect as a baby suckling of stimulating, supposedly, the circuits that would cause you to make more milk. So, and a woman who is not pregnant and has not had a child can produce milk if there is enough stimulation. Cows have to have one calf first, I think. And then you just keep up the stimulation and they keep making milk. Now, what we have not discussed at all is what goes on in these black boxes by the effectors. how is it that something like insulin will cause liver to release glucose? No, insulin causes liver to take up glucose, and glucagon causes liver to release glucose. So we'll talk about that next time, and then we'll go on to talk about other hormones as well.